You're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter. Rebecca Traister is an American author and writer at large for New York Magazine and The Cut, and a contributing editor of Elle Magazine. She's the author of All the Single Ladies, and her new book, Good and Mad, is an exploration into the transformative power of female anger and its ability to transcend into a political movement. Welcome, Rebecca Traister.
Thank you so much for having me, Janine.
Now, before we start, we have a pair of tickets to give away after this interview to see Rebecca Traister in a sold-out event tonight at the Berkeley City Club at 7 p.m. So stay tuned after the interview and be caller number 5 to win tickets today.
Now, where would you say women's collective anger is in your estimation at this moment after the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court and the numerous sexual assault allegations that were not extensively investigated?
I think that the anger is in a couple different places. I think there is mass anger on what we would construe broadly as the left, right? I think that there's anger about the way that the testimony was mishandled, that the allegations against him were mishandled. I mean, I was raised believing that the lowest bar we could get for how to take women's voices seriously when they object to an ascent to power was the handling of Anita Hill's testimony in 1991. And somehow they managed to do slightly worse this time. I didn't know it was possible. I truly didn't know it was possible to do it worse than the Senate Judiciary Committee did in 1991 when they were hearing from Anita Hill. But at least they took time. At least they heard from witnesses. Not all the witnesses. There were three other women who could have corroborated her story who Joe Biden chose not to call to testify. They did it badly. They did it horribly. It was a disaster. Clarence Thomas was confirmed and he shouldn't have been. Everybody just did it worse this time, at least as far as the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee went. And I think that the anger of women, the kind of protests that we saw, and the protest even prior to the allegations being made public, you had a mass of women protesters in the original Kavanaugh hearings screaming a sort of renewable resource, the women who would scream and get taken out and arrested, and then new women would come into the hearing room and scream and get arrested and taken out. And they were yelling about life and death and reproductive autonomy and health care. And it was a tremendously active protest movement. And then I think that you've seen a lot of public opinion polls that show a lot of women responding in a way that suggests they believe Christine Blasey Ford, that they did not think that Brett Kavanaugh should be confirmed to the Supreme Court. However, you also see the activation of conservative women who have been, by and large, conservative white women who have been prompted in part by the anger expressed by Brett Kavanaugh and the other powerful white men on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, Donald Trump himself, who have been sort of prodded into angry expression on behalf of men, on behalf of Kavanaugh, who are coming at this with their own brand of anger that is fundamentally in defense of a white patriarchy and its continued accumulation of power.
Right. And that was another point. Like, the idea of rage of the oppressed is a threat to the system for those who are exploiting them.
Right. For those who benefit from the power structure. Right. So in white patriarchy, you have and actually, the person who's taught me the most about this is a woman named Brittany Cooper, she teaches at Rutgers, gender studies at Rutgers, and she's the author of a book called Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. And Brittany has really made this clearer than anybody, so I have to cite her when I'm talking about it. But the way that white patriarchy works is, because it's fundamentally a minority rule. You know, it's one small segment of the population with so much power over all these other segments. And how does minority rule perpetuate itself? Well, it has to divide the majority against itself. And so part of what white patriarchy extends to men is patriarchal power. So men of lots of races experience patriarchal benefits, right, within their sexual and domestic relationships, at workplaces, they earn more. And what it extends to white women is white supremacy. So there are benefits that white women accrue via their association with white men. And lots of those women, there are incentives for those women to defend that white patriarchy that they benefit from, that they profit from, and that they want to continue to strengthen. And that's part of what we have always seen in the dynamics. There have always been women angry on behalf of a white patriarchy who were willing to stand in front of schools that were being integrated and shake their fists at black students coming in. Women who, used stories, often made false allegations of sexual harm or assault against black men in the South as a cover for an excuse for racial violence. White women like Phyllis Schlafly, who led an army of other angry white women who were furious in part at the disruptions of the gendered power structure made by a feminist movement in the 1970s. And Phyllis Schlafly on the right led that army of white women to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment in 1982. So anger has also been a power. Women's anger has been a powerful force on the right for a very long time.
And women who identify with the power structure based on being white, and then people who identify with being male on the opposite side. And then also the poor white people who identify with Trump, who's a rich white man, based on being white and male, that they have that in common as well.
Right. It all goes in very interesting directions, right? This is one of the great mysteries of the identification of economically struggling white Americans who are legion, who have genuine economic problems in a nation that is that has such a deep and stark and ugly class chasm. White Americans who are suffering unemployment, job loss, opioid addiction, all things that a Democratic set of policies would better ameliorate, but who are persuaded to support a set of Republican, fundamentally conservative policies that are just going to worsen the problem by enriching the already rich and starving the already not rich in this country. But some of the very powerful messages that Trump sends tie back to that, a sense of what America used to be when power hadn't been challenged and jumbled, a sense of some of the messages that he uses are rooted in a kind of call to white supremacy and to patriarchy, and this sense that if we could sort of push away those who've come banging on the doors, that a kind of power and status might be restored, even though none of his economic policies do anything to actually restore any of that economic stability or status.
And you mentioned in your book about the insider status, and that's some women like Kellyanne Conway and Sarah Huckabee Sanders feel like they benefit from insider status. What's the myth of insider status?
Well, I think that, again, it's this sense that women who have proximal power via their association with powerful white men are incentivized to protect those powerful white men against any incursions or critiques coming from outside, whether that's other women, whether it's more broadly protest groups, the left, Democrats, the ideological opponents. These are women whose support of a power system and participation and rise within it is predicated on their sort of promise to not challenge that power structure.
And how does this connect to enabling in your estimation? I just heard the comedian D.L. Hughley recently say that men are robbing the bank, but women are driving the getaway cars. In some sense.
That's a great line. Right. Well, so this is one of the things. This is one of the reasons that it's hard. My book is about women who are angry about a lot of things. So it's not just about women within a women's movement as we understand it, right? It's women who are angry about unsafe working conditions and who, engaged in some of the first iterations of what would become the labor movement. It's women who were angry about racial inequity and whose actions helped to kickstart a civil rights movement. It's about women and female identifying people who helped to kick off the gay rights movement at the Stonewall Inn. So it's not just about women angry about gender inequity, but where it is about women addressing gendered power imbalances. One of the points I make is that it's very hard. The reason that the women's movement kind of comes along as a mass issue that a lot of people want to engage in and fight about, that tends to happen only every 50 or 60 years. And it's in part because of the nature of gender oppression versus a lot of the other kinds of inequities that we battle. Because women are a majority population. And what that means in practical, like everyday lived terms, is that every woman has men in her life and every man has women in his life. So if you're going to challenge and take apart and work to change the power imbalances between men and women, what that means for everyone engaged in that is that it's going to have an impact on your most intimate relationships, whether those relationships are sexual, romantic, social, familial, with your fathers, your brothers, your best friends, your colleagues, your bosses on whom you're dependent for your raises. He was your mentor, you know, these things. And that requires an investment and a willingness to have real disruption in your personal intimate life. And that's a really hard ask for people. It is so much easier to drive the getaway car, right? It's so much easier to, like, just emotionally easier to not engage completely.
And to look the other way when other women are being assaulted.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's one of the things about race. One of the things, you know, there's a question about coalition. And is coalition possible and practical moving forward between white women and non-white women within a women's movement, right? Is it something that we can get to in a way that works and then doesn't just replicate all kinds of inequalities? And one of the things that is fascinating is that because of the way that white women, and this includes me, benefit from white supremacy in ways that tie us to the fate of white men, that has worked in many instances to cut those white women off from natural alliances that they would feel with non-white women. So they are more attached in their intimate relationships to white men than they are into anything that somebody might refer to as like a sisterhood or a coalition of women. And yes, so these are the things that are used to cut space between people who might theoretically be allies in a subjugated majority where all of these kinds of oppressions are interlocked. That's one of the ways that white supremacy works to sort of pull in white women and separate them in their circumstances and the nature of their fights and their perspectives and their realities from non-white women, making alliance very fraught and often difficult.
And that was another question that I had too, in terms of feminism. You mentioned being divided or having racial divisions. Does that explain the skepticism about feminism from many women of color, that it's a white women's movement?
Yes. Well, in part, one of the realities is it's not a white women's movement because women of color have often been the pioneering thinkers and leaders behind so much of feminist activism. If you look just, for example, at sexual harassment, right? It's not just Anita Hill who testifies in 1991. It's women of color in the 1970s, Carmita Wood at Cornell University, Michelle Vinson, who's a bank teller. It's Black women who bring many of the very first legal cases that identify sexual harassment in a workplace. And they're borrowing in part from law around racial discrimination that has been laid out during the civil rights movement of the 1960s. In the 1970s, they bring many of the first cases. They work their way up through the court. And in 1986, the Supreme Court rules that sexual harassment is barred under the Civil Rights Act. And then 5 years later, Anita Hill testifies. Tarana Burke is the founder of a Me Too movement that aims to use personal narrative and personal testimony to make clear the ubiquity of sexual assault, particularly for women and girls of color. That movement then, in 2017, after the revelation that some very powerful white women had experienced violent sexual assault at the hands of Harvey Weinstein, and then, of course, the many other stories that spill out after that, a lot of that history of all of this gets erased, and you lose the Black women who, in the popular mainstream narrative, you somehow lose the Black women who were the pioneering agitators, thinkers, the women who first brought the cases. In some cases, Pauli Murray, who is an incredible legal thinker, who laid down the groundwork for all kinds of both racial and sexual discrimination cases, both Thurgood Marshall and Ruth Bader Ginsburg have thanked Polly Murray, who is a non-gender conforming woman of color in the mid-20th century. But Polly Murray is so often left out of the story of the women's movement. So it's a myth that it's a white women's movement. And it is, in fact, a movement that has often been powered by the pioneering, groundbreaking work of women of color. But those women of color are not broadly celebrated or known. Very few women within the women's movement are known. I should say that straight up, right? But then the ones that are tend to be white middle-class women who, again, thanks to their closer proximity to the power source, right, a white male-led media, white male politics, A, when they get involved, tend to have more leverage, right, and make people pay attention because they have more power to begin with, and B, are the ones who draw the attention of you know, storytellers, whether they're our politicians or our media or our political journalism, storytellers in industries that are still also dominated by white men. So it's not that it's not a movement of women of color. It is a movement built by women of color. It's one that has been recast too often as a white women's movement. And I think that in what's happening now, you're seeing a struggle to make that better. And I'm not going to predict whether it's going to work or not because, you know, there's a lot of I don't know that there's going to be an answer. But I think there is an effort to address these inequities and elisions and erasures of the past. You saw it around the planning of the Women's March in the wake of the 2016 election when 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. And then a few white women were so angry in the wake of the election that night, they said, we're going to have a march on Washington. And it was white women. And then the first thing they did was say they were going to call it the Million Women's March, which is the name of a black woman-led protest from years earlier in Philadelphia that they co-opted without realizing because they didn't know the history of this protest movement. They didn't. And so, but what happened is that women of color organizers from other movements came in and organized the Women's March. And it was the thing and made it an incredibly intersectional, broad, progressive agenda. It was a remarkable feat of organizing and also of forcing people into dialogue. And one of the organizers, Linda Sarsour, has said many times, and I quote her in my book saying this, contentious dialogue is by design. We got to air this stuff out. We got to talk about why we're angry at each other within this movement if we're going to grow. And that happened in the lead up to the Women's March. And the Women's March turned out to be the single biggest one-day political protest in this country's history.
And the Million Woman March actually was a spinoff of
the Million Man March. Right. Yes.
And that's a kind of razor thin edge for a lot of black women who feel like they have to choose sides. Mm. Are they going to be part of a black movement for justice against police brutality, or are they going to be part of a women's movement specifically for women's rights? So it's
And I think it's important that we flip the situation a little bit so that it's not black women who feel that they need to choose, but white women who feel it's incumbent on them to participate in both, too. And that is the ask. There's a very famous sign. I think it was held by a white man. I wish this weren't true because I'm like, clean up your own house before you come to us. But it is a very powerful sign that read, I'll see all you nice white ladies at the next Black Lives Matter march. Right. And that was a question that was asked. Is that the first Women's March, I believe, was that sign. And this is a powerful question. Right. Are white women going to realize that it's not just about showing up for issues that directly affect them, but also going out and taking a look at how the issues that they understand affect them, gender inequality, whether it's sexual harassment, abortion, are deeply connected to the kinds of economic and racial inequities and injustices that have brought women of color into not only the fight for gender equality, but also for all of these against all these other kinds of oppressions and subjugations. And are white women going to go beyond their own experience and extend themselves to be allies in other fights? And that's the question. And the answer will come in fits and starts. I mean, I, as a white lady, I'm always conscious of being like the optimistic one who's like, yeah, I think we can do this. And it's like, I'm so white, right? And I've been watching over the past couple of years. I mean, the Women's March had a convention in the spring of 2018, and they had a session on addressing white supremacy within a women's movement for, you know, basically how to be a better white woman ally. And it was so oversubscribed the first day that they had to hold it again the next day and move it to a bigger space for 500 people. You saw a lot of white women come out. After Charlottesville, there was going to be a neo-Nazi march in Boston the next weekend, and there was a counter protest that was populated by a lot of white women, which was important that they understood that this was their responsibility to come out against this too. One of the things that was remarkable this summer that I was really moved by, actually, because I was like, I don't think I would have seen this a couple years ago. Again, I'm aware of the fact that as a white lady, I'm like perhaps patting white ladies on the back too much, but in the wake of Nancy Pelosi censuring Maxine Waters, there was this summer when during the immigration policy fight over family separation, there was a period in which protesters were interrupting Republican dinners, and Maxine Waters said encouraged gathering, protest. It was incredible. To my mind, it was incredibly correct and righteous. And the leaders in her party, including Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, censured her for it and said that's not what we stand for. And one of the things that surprised me this summer, it's a small instance, but that white women wrote a public letter to Nancy Pelosi explaining how the vilification of a black woman, like how her censure of Maxine Waters' anger fit into a history of white supremacy within a women's movement. And it was a good letter, and 6,000 ladies signed it within the first couple weeks. And I mean, again, it's small. That's not the same as actual, like, decades-long coalition and looking to women of color for leadership. And we're, you know, it's a small thing. But it's a thing that I don't know that I would have seen happen 5 years ago.
And the black women that you mentioned before, where you're saying that they were pioneers of the women's movement, did they identify as feminists?
Some did and some didn't. I mean, I think that there's so many of the, when you read about black women within women's movements and civil rights movements, often, as you described, are sort of women who are being asked in some ways on both sides to pick. And I mean, this has been written about so many times. It's something Shirley Chisholm, who is the first black congresswoman, she was from New York. She ran for president in 1972. I talked to Barbara Lee, who is the congresswoman from the Bay Area. Who's pretty much my favorite politician in Washington. And she came into politics thanks to Shirley Chisholm. She got involved in her 1972 presidential campaign. And one of the things she talked about was how lonely Shirley Chisholm was in Congress, because Shirley Chisholm was a feminist. She was engaged in the women's movement. She worked alongside Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and Bella Abzug, and she was a founder of NARAL, I believe. She organized, she went to the women's conventions. She was also very involved. She was very involved with the Congressional Black Caucus, but she felt alienated by both. She felt that fundamentally the men of the Congressional Black Caucus and the women, the white women of the women's movement, none of them really gave her the support or community or this is something that Barbara Lee was saying. She was just alienated. She was within a structure that wasn't built for her. And even the groups that she was a part of, she didn't feel like she quite fit into either of them. And I think that's, you know, I remember posts during the 2008 election written by black women about being felt like they had to choose between being black or being a woman, like, which is harder. Everybody's always ready to cite somebody saying, oh, it's been harder for me because I've been a woman, or it's been harder for me because I've been black. But black women are often put in this position of being asked to choose which identity more directly shapes their lives. And white women are very rarely asked about how their gender and race shapes their affiliations politically or ideologically, when of course it has shapes our affiliations just as much.
And I wanted to talk to you also about the anti-feminist backlash, the men's rights movements that have sprung up, and the nostalgia about the good old days, like Make America Great Again, now that Brett Kavanaugh has been confirmed a threat to Roe v. Wade. What does this mean for women in America right now?
Well, it means that the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh means that it's the rest of our lives. and that there's no. I think that because being engaged in protest movements, social movements, attempts, if you're a part of a less powerful entity trying to exact change in a more powerful entity, it's really hard. It's taxing. And there are so many defeats because the entity that has more power has more power. And so it gets to confirm its justices, even in the face of mass disapprobation, even in the face of mass protest and evidence that that he's perjured himself and that he assaulted people and that he, you know, in the face of everything that should be rational, power has a way of accruing to the powerful. And so if you're part of the less powerful entity that's trying to change those things, you're looking at, you know, feelings of defeat and despair and not having clear avenues open to you. And it's really hard. And the tempting thing to do is to look to the next moment, like, we'll just have to get through the midterms and then we can go back to normal, right? We just have to get to 2020. We just have to get rid of Trump and we can go back to normal. I can feel that because it's hard, right? But what the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh should let us all know is that there's no going back. This is the rest of our lives. This is a generation's worth of law. And what this court will do is actually undo the progress made by previous generations and previous social and political movements that were that less powerful, acting often after decades and centuries of organizing and work to finally exact some change from the power structure, whether that means abolition and citizenship and enfranchisement for black men and then enfranchisement for women, but not all women, because black women and men in this Jim Crow South still couldn't vote until the Voting Rights Act. I mean, this is centuries to get toward enfranchisement. And what the Supreme Court has already done is got the Voting Rights Act, and it will go further. It's not just Roe v. Wade. It's collective bargaining rights. It's affirmative action. You know, they have it within their power to affect people's access to birth control. And part of the mission of this court, as it has been formed by Donald Trump, a politician who was elected without popular support, right? A minority of American voters voted for Donald Trump, and yet he is our president. But what that means is that we're in this for as long as any of us who are now breathing can see. And that means, I think, a real recalibration in our heads and thinking, right, this isn't just get me through this administration or get other people through this administration. This is, okay, this is the work of our lives.
And you say that many movements occurred based on women's anger, such as the suffrage movement. But what about the civil rights movement? That's largely believed to be fueled by courageous resistance rather than anger.
I don't know that anger is at odds with courageous resistance. I think that one of the things we do to anger, especially when it's expressed by women or in many cases people of color, is we think of it as automatically a bad thing, a divisive, confrontational, violent thing. That's not always what anger can be, those things, and I don't want to pretend that it doesn't have all those negative associations too, or that they're invalid. But anger can be catalytic and connective. And so we can think of two instances in 1955. I write about this in the book. There are two instances that I think we would agree, most people who know even the retrospective history of the civil rights movement, which is often at odds with the actual history of the civil rights movement, but most people recognize from 1955 two instances that sort of helped light a fire under what would become, you know, under the civil rights movement at that stage. And that was the murder of Emmett Till, who was 14 years old and murdered after being falsely accused by a white woman of having made a pass at her and brutally beaten and left in a river. And when his body was found, they tried to bury it and not bring it back to he was down south, and they tried to not bring it back to Chicago, where his mother, Mamie Till, lived. And she insisted that the body be brought back to Chicago. And then the coroner said, you can't open the box. And she said, I'll get a hammer and open it. And the coroner gave in and he opened the box. And she saw her son's horribly mutilated body. And she decided that she wanted to have an open casket funeral and publish images of his body in Jet magazine. And I've always known about Mamie Till, and I think Mamie Till is recognized as a transformative figure in the civil rights movement, but the way she's presented to us always is in grief, which is obviously true, right? Obviously, she was in terrible grief and sorrow over the violent murder of her son, a child. But when I went back and thought about Mamie Till, I was like, you don't make that set of choices just because you're sad. There's anger there, but we don't, because we think of anger as bad, we don't want to say she's angry because we're discouraged from seeing the anger that propels things like, I'm going to make sure this country sees what was done to my son's body. And so she's never presented as a figure who's angry. Maybe she wouldn't have ever wanted to be presented as a figure who's angry because we're trained to feel like we shouldn't be angry, and like it's unattractive if we're angry, and like it undermines from our point if we're angry. But when I watch, there's a documentary made 10 or 15 years ago about Mamie Till. I watch Mamie Till speaking even 50 years after her son's death. And it's so clear that anger was a part. Of course it was. Of course it was. And the same thing is true of the other person we know from that same year, is Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat on the bus. And I was taught about a version of Rosa Parks that was very tired, stoic, prim. She was a seamstress. I knew she was a seamstress, right, when I was in elementary school. But no one ever told me that she was a lifelong activist and fighter against racist oppression. She was an investigator for the NAACP. She was politicized. She sat on that bus and didn't give up her seat on purpose. It was a political act. So much in Rosa Parks' life was motivated by her anger at racial injustice. But no one ever taught me that. But they taught me she was a seamstress, right? We are not taught to see anger as part of a righteous and resistance. The words that you use to describe the civil rights movement. If people weren't angry at racist oppression, I can't imagine that they would have engaged in that decades-long struggle. But we're not taught to value the anger of oppressed people. And so in many cases, we're discouraged from even seeing it or recognizing it for what it was.
So you recognize the difference between righteous anger and possibly another destructive form of anger.
Yeah. I mean, I think all these kinds of anger. I'm not doing a like salesman's pitch for anger in all its forms, right? I say in the book, I look at anger within political movements, and of course there are really great books that are about the psychological dimensions of anger with regard to women. There's a book that's out right now by Soraya Chomali called Rage Becomes Her that delves much more into the way we're taught as children, girls, how to not express or suppress our anger. My book is more about anger's use within political movements. And within those movements, I actually see it as being a lot like fuel. I think it's a powerful propellant and accelerant for social movements that you kind of need to be angry about what's wrong with the world in order to get the energy to get up off your couch to try to make it right. But it is also combustible. And of course, there is anger, as we've talked about, between allies, within coalitions, and that anger can divide coalitions. The anger, especially if it's not given an outlet, if it's not respected, you know, or understood as politically consequential, it can turn inward. It can be very self-destructive. And I think it can, so many women who feel anger but don't feel like they have any liberty to express it without doing damage to themselves, without sounding like they were crazy or making themselves unattractive, they keep the anger in. And I think that leads to all kinds of problems. I'm not saying that anger is an unalloyed good, but I am saying that the way we cast it is always bad if it comes from women, whether that means saying that, oh, you're going to sound crazy, or you're going to be scary, you're going to be threatening, you're going to sound like a baby, you're not going to be taken seriously, you're going to undermine your own point, or whether we say, no, it's bad for you and it's destructive and it's all about confrontation. I see anger as having other qualities that I'd like to talk about. And I see anger as being potentially connective between women. I think one of the reasons we discourage women from expressing their anger at injustice is because if they keep it inside, then they're isolated in those feelings. But if you yell, you become audible to a woman down the street, and then she might be angry about the same thing, and then you can meet each other and work together. I think anger, the expression of anger for women, can involve simply being able to express themselves using the full range of human emotions. I mean, we permit it for men, right? It makes sense to us that men are angry about things, and men have outlets for expressing their anger. And I think that women being able to express their anger and hear it respected and taken seriously is a good thing, a liberating thing, a freeing thing. It can get it out of you. It can lead to cooperation and potential coalition with other women who share your fury. And so I am on the side of excavating the positive and joyous, and that's something else Brittany Cooper writes about in Eloquent Rage, is the joyous dimensions of anger and owning anger and letting it propel you in directions that aren't necessarily destructive or self-destructive.
We're speaking with Rebecca Traister, author of Good and Mad, an exploration into the transformative power of female anger and its ability to transcend into a political movement. Well, what about the entrapment that you write about, the heavy price of rage, the difference between Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony and Brett Kavanaugh's?
Right. So that gets to the problem of how we receive the rage, right? It's because it's like anything else, a system that wasn't built to make room for women's anger is going to punish that anger. And so there's nothing in my book, I want to be clear that there's nothing in this book that's telling readers, like, go out and be angry, right? I mean, if you have the ability to do that, terrific. But I write in there about how kind of salubrious it was for me. I lived in like an anger biodome. I got to write the book. I was being paid for it. I am personally deriving benefit. Editors were taking my words seriously. It was like a magical place that most people don't have any access to, that I got access to, and I felt great. It was terrific. But this is not in any way some advertisement for, like, women go out and do this, because there are prices to be paid in a world that does not want to offer women's anger that kind of respect. If you're angry at your boss for ill treatment in a workplace and you express that anger, there are prices that you may pay. You may not get that promotion. You may get fired. You may get a reputation as difficult or crazy. If you are a woman of color who is arrested for no reason whatsoever, you have every right in the world to be livid and furious. But if you express that fury to an arresting officer, well, then you risk incarceration and death. The world is not receptive to women's anger. And so the thing that we have to, there are a couple things that I would like to start doing differently to try to alter the system and the structures and how they hear, absorb, and understand women's anger. And that is, first of all, to listen to it, right? So when we're hearing the coverage of Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh and the protesters, and we hear the protesters described by a right-wing media host of Fox News correspondent this weekend as screaming animals who needed to be tasered, or by Donald Trump as an angry mob, and he compares them to arsonists, or by Marco Rubio as an angry mob. That's how they describe anger coming from women who have just been run over, their stories not listened to, not believed. They're in an effort to install a court that is then going to police their bodies. Right? They have every rational reason, every political reason, every valid reason to be angry. And yet their anger is cast by the powerful entity as disruptive, dangerous, mobbish, and animalistic. At the same time, we see headlines about how Brett Kavanaugh's anger on behalf of himself and his power and the attempts to thwart his accumulation of further power were a grave injury to himself. And we read analysis that tells us that that helped him. And we understand that it probably did, with the powerful men sitting on the Senate Judiciary Committee and with the senators and with Susan Collins, that call, that aided by Lindsey Graham and Donald Trump saying, this man has been attacked, was enough to spur support of him. And so, A, it's keeping our ears open and our eyes open for how these messages work to devalue women's anger and value powerful white male anger. And the other thing is, we can change the way we behave with regard to women's anger in our lives and in our social, political, and professional spheres. We can start listening to women's anger differently, valuing it more, being curious about it. It's not just about how we choose to express our anger. It's about how we choose to listen to the anger of others.
So you also say that there's no 21st century revolution that will happen without women's rage.
Well, there, I would say that rage will be a crucial component to political change for women. Now, that rage could operate in a couple of different directions. but I think there's no way that you see power structures upended if you don't have people who are angry about those power structures and their abuses to begin with.
And are women well on their way, would you say?
I think women are at the beginning. I mean, not at the beginning. We are well on our way insofar as we are playing parts in stories that have extended hundreds of years behind us and are likely to extend hundreds of years in front of us if the planet survives, which is a big question. I think there is so much work to be done and that there are so many inequities to be addressed and so much education that we all need to get, myself very much included. I think that we are in the midst of a very long process and that should not be deadening. That should be inspiring because generations came before us and gave their lives to the project of trying to make the United States better and something closer to what its initial promise was. And many of them gave lifetimes to that work, and we benefit from the lives that they lived. And it is our responsibility to live our lives engaged in that same struggle.
And what does that revolution look like?
Oh, I think it could take any form. I think that there are so many things that need to be, I mean, there are so many individual areas that need to be revolutionize? Do we revolutionize our view of bodily autonomy? Do we revolutionize our economic system? And do we question capitalism so profoundly that we can rearrange it and make ensure that resources are more evenly distributed, more justly? Do we revolutionize our penal system and our criminal justice system and our policing practices in ways that don't leave segments of the population so vulnerable to incarceration and injury and death? I mean, there are so many angles from which we need to revolutionize this country. And I think that each one of the transformative social movements that has preceded us has sort of gotten a bunch of things done, and that an ideal future would entail progress on all of these fronts.
And what would you say hasn't changed in what women have been taught regarding their anger in the last 50 years?
I think a lot hasn't changed. I think it's relatively new that we're being encouraged to respect our own anger. I think women are still taught to be nice and polite. I find myself telling my own daughters, and I hear it now, and it just comes out of me. I find myself saying, don't yell. I'm going to understand you better if you just tell me, right? I mean, now I'm not saying I'm wrong to say that. Sometimes when they're yelling at me about a stick of bubble gum, I'm like, no, stop yelling. You know, but I do think that women are socialized still to be polite and accommodating and solicitous, to understand that if we speak out of anger, it may mean that we are taken less seriously or that we are viewed as a threat. I think that many women of color have written about how there's just an assumption as they walk through the world that they're angry, whether or not they're angry at that given moment or not. That doesn't seem to have changed or dissipated. I think women are still vilified for their anger. I think we're in a period in which anger is acting as a connector, and that's a period that we're in which it's being appreciated. And I think this is crucial, and it's one of the things I want to encourage in the book, is to appreciate, listen to, and be curious about other people's anger and other women's anger. But I don't think that reverses or mitigates so many of the messages that's still transgressive for us to take our own anger and the anger of other women seriously.
And what has changed in the last 50 years regarding women's anger?
Well, I think you have more models for angry women in a public sphere simply because over the past 50 years, there are more kinds of women in more public spheres. I mean, it's, you know, in many cases, sort of small and small numbers of women in those public spheres. But we have models in the music world and in the art world and in the political world for women who are transgressing in some way, who are talking about their fury. The protest world, there are you know, we have movements led by women, with women as the forefront, Black Lives Matter, the slut walks, politicians, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York, who talks about a left politics with vigor, Elizabeth Warren, who's out there talking about anger and saying, I am angry, in a way that Hillary Clinton might have said, but was never actually, like, it didn't work for her. I think we're adjusting our ears to the idea that our political leaders, our protest leaders, and our artists might be angry, and that anger might motivate some of the work that they do. So I think that a lot of progress is about exposure, and a lot of social progress is rooted in the impulse to make things visible. And one of the things that has become more visible is the way in which women's rage, including rage at inequality, is behind some of the work they do in the world.
Well, Rebecca Traister, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rebecca Traister is an American author and writer at large for New York Magazine. Her new book, Good and Mad, is an exploration into the transformative power of female anger and its ability to transcend into a political movement. Rebecca Traister will appear tonight at the Berkeley City Club as part of the Bay Area Book Festival's Women Lit series. She will join Lauren Schiller of Inflection Point, a podcast and public radio show about how women rise up. This event is sold out. We have one pair of tickets to give away to you, the listeners. Again, that's Rebecca Traister tonight, Wednesday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Berkeley City Club, 2315 Durant Avenue in Berkeley. Again, this event is sold out. We will be offering one pair of tickets to caller number 5 at 510-848-4425. Once again, the number is 510-848-4425. And that's to get tickets to the sold out event to see Rebecca Traister tonight at the Berkeley City Club.